Good morning. It's the show on 91.5 KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later this hour, we continue our Homeless in Plain Sight series. But up first, it's our Friday news cap. And here are some voices from the news this week.
It's going to cause a rift in the delegation, without a doubt. But the relationship between one member of Congress and another member of Congress is not more important than the insurance of 24 million people.
That's $14 billion. That we essentially said goodbye to. Yet we give away all these tax credits with the intent of bringing in more revenue, but it's the same size budget a decade later with 500,000 more people in Arizona. So where's all this revenue that's flooding into the state?
Not taxing something is not the same thing as giving it away. Giving it away suggests we own it. We don't. This is Taxpayer Monday we are talking about. And we are just talking about not taxing it as much.
Obviously, it was not done in an efficient fashion. When you fire probably, arguably, the most respected person in America, you'd better have a very good explanation. And so far, I haven't seen that.
With us now to offer their analysis of the top stories are Felicia Rodellini, former Arizona Attorney General nominee, and Vernon Parker, former Paradise Valley Mayor. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Felicia, let's start off with the legislature. Big things going on related to education. Before we get to the ESA and voucher discussion, there's also been sort of this portrayal of maybe a rift between university funding taking priority, perhaps, as opposed to K-12 funding. And Democrats wanted teachers to get a bigger raise than they'll ultimately get. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that the Democrats held out for a measly 4% increase in teacher pay when Ducey was promoting and mandating, essentially, in his policies, a 1% raise. At the end of the day, he negotiated with his far-right colleagues rather than work with the Democrats on his own priorities, at least the priorities he said he had with respect to education.
Vernon, do you think that the 1% over two-year pay increase that teachers ultimately got in the budget, will that stem the tide of teachers leaving the state, do you think?
I don't think that would stem the tide, but I think that we should put the children before politics. And the K-12, to me, is the most important thing that we can do because we would not have higher education without K-12 funding. So
there is a connection. It doesn't make sense, it sounds like you're saying. It doesn't make sense to do a lot for universities if you're also not doing at least something
for K-12. Well, you have to do a lot more for K-12 because that's the building block. That's the foundation. That's where we have to start. So we have to invest K-12 or we will not have a strong building block for the university systems.
I agree. I agree with Vernon on that. And I also agree that we need to make sure public education continues to be the great equalizer for all community families, working class families, the poor, families of color. And this is what my concern is with the entire education policy of our governor and the majority of the legislators. It's not doing its job of providing that opportunity for all students to excel and have their dreams come true.
Well, another debate that came up recently had to do with the basis schools doing very, very well, a charter school in Arizona, doing quite well in terms of the numbers, and maybe the traditional public schools falling off on that. Now, charter schools are public schools, but not traditional schools in that sense. Vernon, what do you think about that says about the prioritization of what Arizona is doing at this point as it relates to education? When, yeah, the basic schools are doing well, which is a plus. Obviously, we want all schools to do well. But does that indicate that we're moving in a certain direction? ESAs, vouchers,
so.
Et cetera.
Well, the ESA vouchers, I really believe, will change the face of education. I believe in it. I really do believe that when you give, well, let me just personalize it. Okay. My grandmother, she raised me, okay? And I grew up in an area. Snoop Dogg lived around the corner, and I went to, had I gone to the high school that I should have gone to, I would not be sitting here today. I was bused. I went to an affluent high school, a very good high school. I learned about education. I said, oh, my goodness, these people, they have homework? What is homework? You know, my grandmother, she could not read, she couldn't write. So I was introduced into that environment, and it gave me a greater appreciation as to what education really is. And had I not had that opportunity, God knows what would have happened to me.
Do you, we've, you know, talking about the ESA bill, and yesterday a group pulled papers at the Secretary of State's office to collect signatures to refer that issue to the ballot, wanting voters to weigh in on it. A lot of critics are saying, yes, it's great that students and their families have a choice of where to go. But at the same time, by doing this, you're just making the traditional district schools, public schools, which are underfunded as it is, more so. I'm curious, Vernon, do you think that this effort has a chance to be successful? I mean, it's a lot of signatures and not a lot of time.
I think that's a false statement, because when you look at states like Florida, Louisiana, Ohio, Indiana, those states were the ones that when you had the voucher programs, that those states, the public education, those schools went up. Now, I will tell you this. If we do not have a great education system, and I would ask my friend Felicia this, if your child were in a school that, drugs, gangs, violence, would you keep your child there for the sake of public education?
I would keep my kid in a public school because there's
a
value
like
system.
One,
there is
a
value.
Like
there is a life lesson value
I
here.
I grew up in a school just like that one. Would you keep your child in a school that was riddled with drugs, gangs, and violence?
Yeah.
You would.
I'll tell you something, Vernon. Your argument is a perfect example of why what ESA does is to undermine and deteriorate public schools. You said it yourself. You said you were bused to an affluent school. That tells me right there that the education system was flawed in that it was underfunding schools in areas with underprivileged families. The education system of our country was built on the fact that kids that came from poor families and working class families had the opportunity to get a great education. So instead of looking at the root cause of why your school had problems and had drugs and had issues, you're looking at escaping the problem and putting a Band-Aid on it. And that's what the ESA does.
I would agree with you, but then both of us would be wrong. The issue is this. Look, I will tell you this. You would not keep your child there. You would not do that, because I saw it, stabbings, kids, no homework, nothing. We want the best for our children. Why should a poor kid in a unprivileged setting remain there?
That's no, exactly
they should
what
not
we've
stay
set
there.
Up.
They
we've
should not
set
stay
set
there.
But ultimately,
though,
if ESAs do move forward in this sense, though, and they're not limited to a certain number, let's say there's a cap. There's going to be a cap if, in fact,
it's
this 5, goes forward.
5,500 per year,
and there could be a cap up to 32,000. In fact,
that's
that goes.
Right.
But at what point does it become? Does that maybe cause improvement somehow in the way the system is set up? Or are we looking at a system where ultimately the more ESAs, the more vouchers we have, then that eliminates what the public school system does now? As opposed to trying to improve it, are you just chipping away at it and sort of moving to a stage where you get rid of it? And then what does that do? Does that cause opportunity? I mean, if we end up with 500,000 vouchers, then what does that actually mean? I guess I'm wondering.
But we've seen in Florida, Ohio, Indiana, Louisiana, that the public schools have gotten better because of vouchers, because they have to compete. Look,
Let me talk about that.
We have Sears, we have JCPenney. They closed because of Amazon, because they could not compete. They did not change their philosophy. They did not change their thought.
We cannot compare our public education system to the capitalistic society we live in. When we have an education system that favors the wealthy, and that's what the voucher system does, because it allows our taxpayer money to be funneled to reimburse people who already have the privilege and the opportunity to have the education that Vernon is just talking about. And I can give a personal example. I grew up working class family, Catholic. My parents had a business in their home. I saw them work 7 days a week, not to just put food on the family and put some money in the bank, but to send their kids to parochial school. Not once did they ever complain that they were also paying taxes to underwrite and fund our public education system while their own kids weren't participating in it. This is a life lesson about service and building a community.
Fern, one more brief comment.
Okay,
and
I'll,
this is,
I'll
this
be
is
very
the news
brief.
Cap, not the education cap.
Okay, I'm sorry, Steve. I'll be very brief. I just challenge you to send your child to a gang-ridden school where they have no homework, there's nothing there, and they cannot read, they cannot write. So if you want to do that, fine.
I believe
that
you're not solving the problem,
Vernon. If I were a parent, with all due respect, I would send my school, I would send my child to a school that is passing, not failing.
What I would do is I'd run for the school board.
Would
and
you
I'd
hire
run
someone,
for the legislature, and I'd change the
policy. Would you hire
policy.
Someone who is a bad employee?
I think that you,
would you
are
fire
mixing
who's
apples
a bad
and or- oranges.
All right, guys, we'll take
I'm
this outside.
I'm not answering that question.
In 15 minutes, we'll take this outside. So, Felicia Rodolini and Vernon Parker, it's our Friday newscap on the show. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. The biggest national news out of Washington this week was President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey, who had seemingly displeased people in both major parties. But the timing of that firing has also made a lot of people very uncomfortable. With us for a few minutes to talk about the Comey firing is former U.S. Attorney for Arizona Paul Charlton, currently a partner with the law firm Steptoe & Johnson. He was fired from his position as U.S. Attorney after a disagreement with the Bush administration. Paul, good morning. I promise not to ask you about vouchers, but thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Steve.
So when you heard of the Comey firing, what were you reminded of?
Well, not so much my own personal experience as I was Watergate and Richard Nixon, who was under investigation by the lead prosecutor, a gentleman by the name of Archibald Cox, and Richard Nixon firing Archibald Cox as he approached Richard Nixon and almost obtained, and they eventually did obtain, Richard Nixon's tapes. And there are a lot of very similar sounding events that are taking place today.
Including President Trump this morning suggesting that Director Comey better hope there were not tapes of his conversations with the president as far as giving information to the press. Paul, there's been a lot of discussion about comparisons between what happened with FBI Director Comey and the Saturday Night Massacre with President Nixon. Is it a perfect analogy, do you think?
It is about as close to a perfect analogy as you can have. This will be, I'm quite certain, this generation's Watergate. Much like what happened with President Nixon, at the time that Archibald Cox was conducting his investigation, there was no certainty that Nixon was involved in wrongdoing leading up to his own election. And there is no absolute certainty about what, if any, degree of wrongdoing President Trump was involved in with regard to the Russian interference. But what we can say is true is that Jim Comey, like Archibald Cox, was in charge of that investigation. And the timing here is more than suspicious.
Paul, I think that is the timing is what concerns most people because it looks so transparent when it comes to it. But a lot of people would say, all right, President Trump has only been in office for a few months. This is not like a Watergate cover-up that went on for a number of years. And that James Comey, even if he is above board ethically, people didn't think he was necessarily effective in that position. If, in fact, this had been done in January, if it had been done perhaps even by President Obama, would there be this controversy surrounding it?
Precisely, the answer is no, there wouldn't have been. There may have been controversy regarding whether or not Jim could have handled the job, and my own opinion is he can and was doing well at it. But the conclusion that many people are, I think, correctly coming to, and that is that this is an attempt to slow and derail the Russian investigation, would not have been a part of that dialogue.
Paul, from a logistical perspective, how significant or not significant is it to an investigation if the person leading it is no longer in that position?
Leadership matters. You have leadership at your station. We have leadership in every company. We have leadership from the President of the United States. That's why we have generals and chiefs of police. Jim Comey was an effective leader on this issue. There will be other leaders. Whether they have the same degree of effectiveness is another reason to be very much concerned. They've put out a list of individuals who are now being considered by the president to be the next director of the FBI. Many of those individuals are partisan politicians. And we have every reason to be concerned that those partisan politicians will not lead the FBI to do an aggressive and impartial investigation of what happened in this election.
Paul Charlton is the former U.S. Attorney for Arizona. Paul, thanks as always.
Thank you, gentlemen.
It's the NewsCap on 91.5. You're listening to the show on KJZZ along with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll continue our conversation with Felicia Rodolini and Vernon Parker right after this. Good morning. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. You've joined us for our Friday NewsCap segment with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're also joined by former Attorney General nominee Felicia Rodolini and former Paradise Valley Mayor Vernon Parker. Felicia, as an attorney yourself, what do you make of what Paul Charlton said about James Comey?
Well, I'm also a former prosecutor in the AG's office, and I agree with Paul and I disagree with Paul. I agree that if the firing had happened on day one, then it would be a different discussion we're having today. Because I think President Trump had grounds to fire Comey from day one. And that was clearly spelled out in Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein's words. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a highly regarded, by-the-book prosecutor who said Comey had bad judgment and making all these public comments about a closed and maybe reopened investigation of Hillary Clinton. Now, if Comey is willing to grandstand to mm-hmm. abuse his power on a high-profile, controversial investigation of a presidential candidate, imagine what he will do with an investigation of the President of the United States. So I think at the point where Trump realized that Comey's behavior, he's a loose cannon, he is a showboat, he is a grandstander. Once Trump realized that that behavior was not going to be to his benefit, and in fact could be to his detriment, then the writing was on the wall. And that's why Trump got fired. And that's,
Comey got fired.
That
Comey,
it, oh, excuse me. Comey got fired because of his own ego and his own bad behavior as prosecutor. Line attorneys, appointed attorneys, they know you don't comment about right. investigations. And that was his problem.
Vernon, do you agree with Paul Charlton's assessment that this incident, this ongoing situation will be this generation's Watergate?
No, I don't. I mean, Paul's a dear friend, and I respect him so much. And I think it's the sign of the apocalypse that I'm agreeing with my friend Felicia over here.
See?
No, but look, I look at Comey. I mean, I've worked for two presidents, okay? And I look at Comey as a political ping pong ball. One day Schumer loves him. The next day he hates him. One day McConnell loves him. The next day he hates him. You cannot lead that way. And he usurped power. Because when you hold a press conference and you tell the attorney general, I'm going to hold this press conference, I'm not going to tell you what the press conference is about, then you go out there, so you have inserted yourself, and quite frankly, President Obama should have fired him at that point because you know, he's not a prosecutor.
Agreed.
He was not the prosecutor at that time. And so he inserted himself into the limelight, and I really don't believe that he could effectively lead. And so what the people have to understand is this. The next FBI director will be appointed by the president and confirmed by the United States Senate. So there will be that vetting process, but he should have been gone a long time ago.
So you don't, it sounds like you don't really buy into the argument, the sort of conventional wisdom that if everybody dislikes you at one point or another, you must be doing something right.
Well, he may be a fine man. I mean, he may be a very good man. But when both of us, we've served in government, and I've worked for two presidents, and had I done what he did, oh my goodness, you'd be gone in a heartbeat.
Public lawyers, public figures have to have their resume up to date all the time because you never know when you're going to walk into a room and you are going to have to maintain your ethics and say something or do something that will get you fired. So I think Comey's issue here is that I think we need prosecutors with cooler heads, and with no ego. And I believe the Trump investigation will continue. Yeah. There are grand juries in Virginia and New York. There are subpoenas being issued. And I believe that the folks that are going to take over that investigation will continue.
And I have one final remark on that. I believe that Steve Bannon will not be our next director of the FBI. Okay.
Going out on a limb on
that. I just hope Jared Kushner isn't.
Now, only because we didn't have enough education conversation in the first segment, we've only got a couple of minutes left here, but I want to get your take on what may happen to either block changes to the voter initiative process or even block the fact that ESAs will be expanded. But let's look at this just in the initiative process generally. Felicia, what do you think about efforts to make it so there can be fewer of these efforts? It's harder to get something on the ballot.
With our partisanship and the way that our state legislature has been performing, we need the will of the people through these initiatives. And any efforts to restrict the ability for the people to speak through the propositions and initiatives, that's a problem. And I really applaud Paul Johnson and Grant Woods for what they're doing.
Amber?
Another sign of the apocalypse. We agree again on this one.
Because uh-oh.
I will tell
you
this. At
the end of the segment now, though.
Yes. And, no, because I think dark money has played a vital role in state politics. And by usurping or taking away the rights of the people of this state to put things on the ballot, I think is further a further cause. And so I really do believe that what Grant Woods and Paul Johnson are doing.
Well, you ran into that as a Corporation Commission candidate.
Oh, yeah. There were 3 million reasons why people didn't vote for me. So there you go.
I know 3 million reasons for that, too.
One other thing we wanted to talk about was something that we had earlier on this week on the show, where we talked about Congressman Ruben Gallego going to Tucson, which is not his congressional district, to, quote, adopt a district, Martha McSally's district. He was upset that she voted for the replacement bill for the Affordable Care Act. This concept of members of Congress, including within a state's delegation, especially a state with as few members of Congress as Arizona, only 9 of them, what kind of practical impact do you think this kind of thing might have?
Well, I have 2 phrases, unprecedented and unstatesmanlike. That was not right. He should stick to his delegation or his congressional district, because that's just partisan politics.
Well, I would say it's unprecedented and unconventional. And this is a time in our politics where unconventional actions are warranted. What we need is courage. And being a Republican in the state of Arizona and running in districts that are safe or close to safe.
An African-American Republican takes courage.
That it takes courage to speak out. And
McSally
needs to have her own town halls in her own district. And Ruben,
which she did.
And Ruben is doing what I think Ruben is well prepared
saw politics,
and performed to
had,
do.
Had nothing to do. It was just all politics.
And politics is how we get people elected.
Well, that's unfortunate.
That's the electoral system.
Let me ask you, though, in this current climate, is it possible to hold a town hall, even in your own district, or if you're a senator in your own state, with your constituents, is it possible to even hold a town hall and actually have a constructive dialogue come out of it?
I do. I think there was constructive dialogue in the town hall that Senator Flake held. Mm-hmm. There was controversy. There was courage in the communication between the people
Agreed.
Attending. It can happen. And the fact that Ruben went to Tucson and had a town hall with a lot of Democrats in McSally's district, it doesn't seem that controversial to me.
I don't believe it was based on his ideological principles. I think it was based on politics, going after a Republican. I mean,
that was a Republican who voted for a bill without the Congressional Office of Budget having an opportunity to say that all talk about the millions of people that will be harmed. That was not courageous. That was negligence on McSally's part.
Guys, we just have a few seconds left, though. But does it matter if this creates a rift in the delegation? We heard the quote from Ruben Gallego saying...
It doesn't matter.
I don't think it matters. No. There's always
this rifts. This will blow away. It will probably see about another one day, and that's it.
They just won't sit next to each other at congressional delegation breakfast.
The breakfast, right.
Well, they probably will. Believe me, they will get over it.
They had worked together in the past. Now, I'm only going to ask Vernon this question because he's a Republican. If Donald Trump were to call you tomorrow and offer you a job, would you take it?
Depends on the job.
Oh, wow.
Well, as I have always said, if I can do something to help the country, I do it, but not for myself.
Former Paradise
but
Valley
would you
Mayor.
Pledge the loyalty oath that
no,
needs
I,
to
I
be
would,
pledged?
I would pledge the loyalty to the American people. That's it.
Okay. Former Paradise Valley Mayor Vernon Parker and former Attorney General nominee Felicia Rodellini, thank you for the lively conversation.